You're listening to What Goes On Here, and I'm Sam Walker. Whoever we are, and whatever we do, we all have moments when we feel like we don't quite fit with the world around us. What Goes On Here is where you can listen to real stories of people who at times couldn't see a way forward, people who found themselves stuck, maybe in a life they never imagined would be theirs, people who had to face their fears, face themselves, but they changed, and changed lives of people around them too. On season two, this is episode five, Colin. Colin Parry is a business coach and a motivational speaker, and he also founded a charity that works to resolve conflict and advocate peace.
Discussion, that's how you lower the temperature. That's how you begin to tackle the core issues that make people hate each other or fear each other. It's not rocket science. It has to be done.
The charity works across the UK and around the world, not just with the victims of violence, but perpetrators too.
To the best of my knowledge, we are the only people doing what we do. And we're doing it well enough to attract considerable support and interest from many quarters that we have to influence.
Colin knows firsthand the devastating effects of conflict. Because in March 1993, his 12-year-old son Tim, out on a shopping trip, was killed by an IRA bomb.
In many other situations, I might have been too embarrassed to say and do the things I said and did, but I knew this was a moment when, for the very last time, I'd be with him and speaking to him. So it was a very powerful few moments, and probably no more than a minute. I don't know, again, how long it was before he just lay still.
When your family, your life, has been torn apart, how do you begin to see beyond your personal grief to try and create a more positive world?
I used to sometimes wonder whether I'd live another 5 years, 10 years, 1 year with the kind of grief that was just ripped you in half. There was absolutely nothing. It was just hopeless and terrifying.
I'd like to talk, first of all, about times when your life really changes.
And one time that I think all of our lives change is when you become a parent. Can you remember becoming a dad?
Vaguely. I mean, it's a long time ago now. My oldest is 38. I can remember being at the hospital and actually reading notes I shouldn't have read because Wendy was in labour, I think, for quite a while, and she was half away with the fairies because they were giving her gas and air. And I decided to thumb through some notes that were on a table. I saw in the notes, no caput. And I remembered school Latin, and caput meant head. And I thought, my God, I'm having a headless child. And I didn't tell Wendy she was having a headless child for obvious reasons. I didn't want to upset her. Of course, needless to say, you cannot have a headless child. And of course, he's now 38. But I do remember that. And then I remember our third child, Abby, who was born on the same day as Dominic, our first, 3 years later. And I remember that because Wendy suddenly said, baby's coming. And we lived about 3-4 miles from the hospital, drove up there, no room on the car park initially, so I dropped Wendy at the door. She went in, I eventually found somewhere to park, I walked in, I was told, you have a daughter. So from dropping her off to getting out of my car and going in, Abby was born. So I remember those two incidents. And strangely and sadly, I don't remember Tim being born, because there wasn't a note in the book and there wasn't a problem parking my car with Tim. But Tim was in between Dom and Abby.
Well, tell me about Tim. What sort of boy was he growing up?
Well, from the earliest recollections, Tim was always cheerful, liked to lark around, liked to act the fool, liked to entertain. He was the cheerful Charlie of the family. He was a great icebreaker. I remember when he was slightly older and we started to take foreign holidays, and we liked camping holidays. We went to France because the weather was better. And I always remember after long and tedious drives from the north of England down to central France, the kids were itching to get out the car and we would unpack. And by the time we'd unpacked, Tim would come back with sort of a gang of kids who he'd gathered together, and then he apportioned them out to Dom and Abby, and they all had instant friends. But that was thanks to Tim. It wouldn't have been Dom and Abby who would have done that. It was Tim. And he just was a fun-loving kid. It doesn't mean he was always in the best of humours. He wasn't. Like any child, he had his bad moments too. He was very accident-prone. He had any number of accidents, and at the time they seemed serious. Of course, looking back, they weren't. But I remember him splitting his chin open both ways, and Abby screaming the house down when she thought she was responsible for one of these and thinking she'd done it and she'd be in great trouble with us. But it was probably triggered by Tim acting the fool, and he paid the price. But yes, he was a fun lover, but also he was a bit of a daredevil. Again, I remember going to a holiday and there was a high diving board, and the kids did, well, they could swim, I think, but they certainly didn't dive as far as I knew. But Tim went up on the top of the diving board and just jumped in, and a few minutes later dived in, and I couldn't believe what I was saying, because I don't think he'd ever done it before. And again, the dive wasn't perfect. It wasn't a Tom Daly dive, but it was pretty good. So that was the kind of boy he was.
And he really loved sport. He played golf, he played squash, but the sport was football.
Yes, Tim was football mad, like me. He quickly bought into the family parry allegiance for Everton Football Club. And I used to take him and Dom to the games. Dom was kind of interested, but he'd mostly look at the crowd. And he remembered there was a match going on where Tim was totally focused on the game. They both wore the shirts. They both knew all the players' names. I took them to the training ground one day, and the famous players of that era, they met many of them, like Neville Southall, who was a great goalkeeper, and others. And they were just, Tim especially was really, really a big fan of the club. But yes, he was having golf lessons, and he played squash with me. I used to take him to squash, and then I'd let him win. And he'd come home and tell Dominic he'd beaten his dad, and Dom would say, "My dad let you win." And then there'd be an argument, because Tim would say, "No, I beat him fair and square. Of course, I did let him win, because he was only 8 or 9, and it was hardly likely he'd beat me at that age." But there we are. Yes, he was a great kid.
You mentioned Neville Southall, famous Everton goalkeeper. And in fact, it was Neville Southall who Tim wanted to emulate. He'd played in goal, hadn't he, in March 93, and it was on the 20th of March, he went into Warrington to buy a pair of, was it Neville Southall shorts or boots?
Yes, shorts, yes. He'd had an emergency appendix operation just 6 weeks before the bombing. It was a serious operation because he was suddenly very, very ill. And when he was operated on and Wendy went to see how he was, she was told he was not to play any sports for at least 6-8 weeks. But because he was a bit of a charmer and could probably wrap his mum around his little finger, after about 3 or 4 weeks, he said he wanted to play in goal. And there was no risk of any damage because goalkeepers just walked 8 feet from post to post, bent down and picked the ball out of the net. So Wendy thought, OK, he's not playing outfield, I'll let him do that. And of course, as luck or bad luck would have it, he saved a penalty at the end of the game. I think his side won, maybe they drew, but anyway, he saved the penalty. So instead of wanting to be Everton's next centre forward, he wanted to be the next goalkeeper, and at the time that was Neville Southall. So hence he was in town on the fateful day to buy a pair of Neville Southall shorts.
You weren't in Warrington on that day, you'd gone to visit family elsewhere. When did you hear that there had been a bombing, and when did you suspect your family, your son, had been involved?
We heard there had been a bombing when we drove back to the house, and there were clusters of neighbours in the street, and the next door neighbour asked us whether we'd heard there'd been a bombing when we got out of the car. We hadn't heard anything about a bombing at all. So Wendy rang around the friends of our children, who were all out with their own groups of friends, and she accounted for Dom and she accounted for Abby. But when she rang Tim's friend's house, Tim's friend's grandmother said the friend, called Pierce, had been injured in the bombing and was in hospital. So instantly we were extremely worried. We drove to the hospital, and in the hospital there were lots of people, members of the public, trying to get to the front table to ask hospital staff if they knew anything about their friends or relatives. And in the end, we too made our way to the table and described him, and the initial news seemed favourable. They didn't have anybody that matched our description. So then Wendy went home with a neighbour who'd kindly gone in with us in case we'd passed Tim en route. So she was gone about an hour or so, and then in the meantime a Catholic priest sort of fixed himself to me for some strange reason and asked what my circumstances were, and then began himself to try and find out anything he could. And it wasn't long after Wendy returned with the news that Tim wasn't at home and they hadn't seen him either, that the Catholic priest asked us would we go with him into a side room. And of course that was about 3 hours on from when we'd first arrived. And immediately, I can't speak for Wendy, but immediately I was worried. I mean, you don't get asked to go into a private room for no good reason. We were there for perhaps a minute or so when in walked a surgeon wearing his hospital greens. And he was carrying a manila envelope. He opened the envelope and a watch and a St. Christopher chain slid out of the envelope. And he asked us, did we recognise these items? And we said, yes, they were Tim's. And he said, I'm pretty sure I'm always giving it word for word because it's one of those things that's etched into your mind. He said, well, I'm really sorry, but I've been operating on your son for the past 3 hours and he sustained extremely serious injuries. If you'll forgive me, I now must get back to what I was doing. And he turned on his tail and went. So in that 60 seconds, we heard the news that you could never, ever imagine you would ever hear. And frankly, couldn't really comprehend. There was stony silence, as I recall, in the room, and neither of us, I'm sure Wendy couldn't either, could begin to understand the enormity of what we just heard.
The surgeon told you your son probably wouldn't survive the night.
Yeah.
But he did. He did survive the night.
Yeah, he did. He did. And that night was an endless night. I don't think either of us slept for more than a few moments. And on the Sunday morning, we went to the hospital on our own. And we were greeted by the hospital chaplain, who took us under his wing, gave us coffee and biscuits, and said, whenever you're ready to visit your son, I'll take you up. So he took me first. I waited outside the curtain. The curtain was drawn around his bed. He was in a ward where other people with minor injuries were in beds, but he was completely hidden behind a curtain. I was left then to decide when I entered, passed through the curtains, and that took me a while because I really was afraid of what I'd see. And what I saw was Tim lying on the bed with his bottom half covered, his top half uncovered, and his head completely and utterly bandaged, totally in stained bandages, blood-stained bandages. And I was aware of not only the awful sight that greeted me, but the slightly strange smell, which we both concluded must have been the smell of the explosives that that had caused the bomb to detonate and injure him. And there were bits and pieces of what I didn't quite understand at the time was shrapnel stuck in his torso, small pieces of black which were embedded, nothing major, but quite a few of them. But it was just not being able to see his face and imagining what had happened to his face and head, which was, again, difficult to describe. And I remember talking to him through the bandages and thinking he might be able to hear me. Stupid, I know, but at the time you don't think and behave rationally. And in the end I left, and then Wendy went in to see him. I don't know how long Wendy was with him now, but after that we thanked the chaplain and we left the hospital. And of course at the time we left, unlike the time we arrived, the press had heard who we were. And so began an endless round of interviews with the press, TV, radio, newspapers, the lot, which went on for a very long time.
Did you have hope over the next few days that your son would survive, that Tim would pull through?
Briefly, yes. On the Sunday, I think it was the Sunday, they said that they were going to move Tim on the Monday to Liverpool to a different hospital where they had neurosurgical facilities, which Warrington General didn't have. And on the Monday morning, we went on a high-speed chase with six police outriders on motorcycles, Tim in an ambulance, and Wendy and I in my car following at high speed. We didn't get stopped anywhere from Warrington, straight through to Walton Hospital. And he was immediately taken in and given over to the care of the staff at Walton.
It was just 5 days after the bomb ripped through Warrington Town Centre that you and your wife, Wendy, were given a horrendous decision to make, and that was whether or not to switch off Tim's life support machine.
Well, it was kind of an option, but it wasn't really, because they are on the day before Tim was allowed to pass, they conducted simple brain tests involving freezing water in the ear, which would ordinarily indicate brain activity. And of course, he had electrodes, I guess, on his head at the time, and they failed to prove any brain activity. And of course, we were told that. At the same time, we were told that really maintaining his breathing with a respirator was futile, because there was no brain activity, and therefore, had the machine not been breathing for him, he wouldn't be alive. So the recommendation was we accepted the inevitability, and we gathered the family around on the day before Tim died, and they all said their farewells. Dom and Abby saw Tim for the first time, as we'd seen him. They couldn't see him, of course. He still had bandages over the whole of his head. But, you know, Wendy's family, my family, could say their goodbyes. And then, rather sadly, the consultant who'd been in charge of Tim's care took us to one side, and he said, in effect, if you're thinking of staying with your child when the machine is switched off, I have to caution you that his body might spasm and leave the bed, almost levitate from the bed, which so horrified Wendy that Wendy couldn't stay in the room in case that happened. So I stayed with Tim at the time and lay with him on the bed, held him, kissed him, told him I loved him, and then I signaled to the technician to go ahead and switch off the machine. So in a matter of 1 or 2 seconds, obviously the breathing stopped immediately. And without being too graphic about it, he turned from pink to blue very, very fast, and he was gone.
You described that, the moment of your son's death and choosing to be with him and, as you said, lie with him and hold him, as serenely awful.
Yeah, it was. It was a kind of awful simplicity and calmness about the room. I mean, there was nobody there other than me and, I think, this technician. There may have been other people, but out of my eyesight, out of my eyeline, may have been a nurse or two. I just don't know now. But it was a very private moment. And, you know, in many other situations, I might have been too embarrassed to say and do the things I said and did. But I knew this was a moment when, for the very last time, I'd be with him and speaking to him, even though my rational mind said he didn't hear me and he didn't know I was there. So it was a very powerful few moments, and probably no more than a minute, I don't know again how long it was, before he just lay still. And clearly they then sort of invited me to leave the room while they did what they had to do with him. The next time I saw him was in the funeral directors.
Less than an hour after Tim had died, you and your wife Wendy gave a press conference. A press conference during which you spoke so eloquently, so passionately about your son. And I know reading reports of journalists who were travelling to that conference, they were saying, what on earth do we ask this man, this woman who've just lost their child? But you spoke to the press and you said in a way that was a form of therapy.
Yeah, didn't know that at the time. But as the days, weeks and months rolled on, I think Wendy would say perhaps more for me than for her, speaking and having an outlet through the press was to be therapeutic for me. I can't say it was necessarily for my wife, but I didn't have to bottle things up. I could speak to people who wanted to hear. And I think that just vented feelings and vented emotions, which I might not have wanted to vent on Wendy or she on me, because there's a terrible choreography that goes on, I think, at times like this, where you're not sure what the other person's thinking, even if they are your partner. You know, we were actually warned by a very good man, a great man, who sadly too many people will have forgotten now, Michael Gordon Wilson, whose daughter died in the Enniskillen bombing in Northern Ireland. And he said to us when he came across to meet us, you will grieve at different times and in different ways, and you mustn't criticise or judge. And he was so right. I didn't think those things would apply to us, but he was right. And you do grieve in different ways and at different times. And it's easy to think I'm grieving more than you are, or I'm sure Wendy would have thought the same about me. And you end up silently judging each other. And in that lie the seeds of further destruction if you're not careful. And I do credit the press, the media, with giving me an outlet, which I think served me well and Wendy was very tolerant of.
You said also at the time, I don't feel anger, I just feel loss. Did you ever feel anger?
No. And again, I think I can speak for us both. No, we didn't. And I can only say that the grief and the loss is so all-consuming that perhaps it forms a barrier through which anger cannot break through. And again, I've spoken to other people who've been bereaved, lost children, and it's not unique to us. And I think many bereaved parents have felt the same thing. And indeed, I've met people who've said that whether children were killed rather than just died. I've met people who've said they forgive the people who have killed their children. That's a different issue for us. We don't, but that's for another day. But this sense of simple loss and emptiness and a vacuum where Tim should have been was what I think we felt for such a long time.
And during this time when you've faced the most awful thing that any parent ever fears, and that's losing their child, of course, you were still a dad, your wife was still a mother, you had two more children who you had to continue to parent and parent them through their grief and their loss as well.
Yeah, true. Again, if I might say so, I think mothers are the strong party in this. I don't know how many dads would eclipse mothers when it comes to situations like this. I think mothers have a special place in the family. Well, they do, don't they? And they're often the anchor and the person around which things happen. They make things happen. And fathers are often, I think, lost souls. And I think very often I felt like that. But thanks to having two other children and a wife who was very understanding, my sanity, and I'm sure Wendy's, survived.
At what point during this grieving process did you start to formulate an idea that actually you could work towards change in the aftermath of what had happened to your son?
Oof, I suppose it was probably a couple of years after we made a BBC Panorama programme. The programme took a month. We spent time in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland and the United States. And by and large, the whole process was very dispiriting and very depressing because there were no obvious signs of any prospects for a peaceful settlement. But there was one day when we spent time in Coleraine in Northern Ireland in a peace farm, and we witnessed young people, Catholic, Protestant, male, female, Unionist, Nationalist, arguing with great energy for their blueprint for the future of Northern Ireland. Diametrically opposed, very hostile often, but what united them all was the principle that there would never be a solution through violence. And although I don't think that struck us in a deep fashion at the time, I do think that 2 years on, when we began to think, what can we do, or is there something we can do which might be of some help, I think the embryonic idea was planted by that day in Coleraine.
How important was a sense of purpose in your grieving process?
I think the sense that we had was a sense of keeping Tim alive. Whether it amounted to a sense of purpose being the trigger, I don't know. I think it was more about we'd lost a child who was 12, who had a right to a full and happy life. He'd been ripped from us. And we couldn't just allow him to be airbrushed out of our family history or out of life in general. I think everything we've done has been motivated by keeping Tim alive in the only way we can, which is by having his name enshrined in our charity, his name enshrined in the peace centre that we've built, and everything else that we do. Along the way, of course, we rightly thought it was proper that we keep Jonathan Ball's name alive as well, of course, but he wasn't our child. We didn't know him. We got to know his family a little. So that was right and proper too. But to keep Tim alive, keep his face alive, his memory alive, not just for the family, but for a good cause, was what motivated us more than anything else.
So after this visit to the Peace Farm, when you saw that actually, through something almost as simple as friendship, through humanising conflict, you could make a difference to conflict. And that's something so many of us struggle with. We look at war zones, whether they're real, whether they're theoretical, and think, well, I'm just a person. I'm not a politician. I don't have any power. And we think, therefore, we are powerless. But you realise that's not the case.
Well, if you've been placed in a position where, through tragedy, you have an insight and an experience which is maybe not unique, but perhaps as close to unique as you can get, then you either let it kill you off slowly, inch by inch, moment by moment, day by day, or you turn it into something which is a powerful force for you carrying on as individuals and as a family, and then taking it beyond that. I'm not going to give it some high moral... I'm not going to give a high moral case for this or argument for this and say we thought in these terms in quite the way I'm saying it now. But looking back, I did think I, in particular, had strongly held views about the Northern Ireland Troubles, based partly on where I was born, based partly on family experience, based partly on education at my school, based also on my education at university. I had an insight into the Northern Ireland Troubles that perhaps wasn't that common in England at the time. And I, maybe not consciously, but I thought perhaps there was something we could do as a family. And the good thing is that Wendy, I don't ever remember her saying, no, I'm not doing that. Her background was different. And she would tell you that herself. But where we balanced each other well and complemented each other well is we weren't competing for the same space, and we would support each other. And she supported these ideas in their infancy.
So tell me about the Peace Centre, that, as you said, bears your son's name and the name also of Jonathan Ball, just 3 years old when he was killed in the same bomb that took Tim's life. What's the premise of the Peace Centre? What happens there?
Well, if I can say so, the Peace Centre came after the foundation. The charity came first in 95, and it worked from our spare bedroom, not in this house, but in a former house. And we did an annual exchange programme between Belfast, Dublin and Warrington. And that was it. That's all we did do until 1998, when we invited Mo Molum to Warrington to see what was going on the fifth anniversary. And we told her about our plans. She offered to help, and she was a considerable help. And the way she helped was in getting us introductions to serious money. And that serious money enabled to turn Wendy's dream of a centre into a reality. And the Peace Centre that you've mentioned, which is a £3 million, that's what it cost 16 years ago, £3 million building, and which is an iconic building and a brilliant physical asset for the charity. That's where we do much of our work, not all of it. We're also doing outreach programmes across the UK, in Ireland, other places. But the home of the foundation is the Peace Centre, and that's a great building. It's got its own power.
And tell me about some of the conversations that happen there. Who do you invite, and what do you get them to talk about?
Well, for the purpose of keeping it fairly simple by way of an explanation, we have two work streams. We have a work stream which is working with survivors, victims and survivors of terrorist attacks. So people living in Britain who've been affected by acts of terrorism, be it troubles in the past or the kind of terrorism of today. And they may have been affected by the Tunisian beach attacks or the Bataclan pop concert attack or the Nice lorry driver. They don't have to have been affected in Britain, but if they're living in Britain, we will try and reach them, or we'll have them referred to us, and we will try and help them in the sense of connecting them with other victims, helping them to understand what's happened, helping them to get through this awful pain, and turning victims into survivors. That's one stream of work. The other stream of work is mostly focused on young people who, by virtue of their faith or their race or their politics or where they live, are at risk of becoming radicalised and taking the kinds of actions that we would rather they didn't. So we have groups referred to us through particular programmes we have by police forces or police and crime commissioners and the like, and we do our best to work with them and give them a chance to step back and think about their attitudes and their beliefs which might be forming. We also work with women's groups. We recognise that women are often an underused resource as mothers and sisters and aunts, and we're trying to give women a voice as well, especially women from third world countries who now live in the UK, so that they recognise they can play a great part in trying to prevent their sons and brothers and fathers and so on of getting involved in, drawn into violent conflict.
You talked about the outreach that you do as part of the centre as well. I'm thinking specifically of a project you did in Leeds, where by talking to two sets of communities within one Leeds school, I mean, you essentially changed the town.
Well, that's a bold claim. I think we certainly changed the school. It was a school, South Leeds High School, a brand new multi-million pound, brilliant new building, populated by the closure of two former schools, one predominantly Asian, one predominantly white, moving them into the new building. And from the early days, there was conflict, sometimes allegedly a lot of violent conflict. They had police visiting the school a lot. I was introduced to councillors, Leeds councillors, who approached me and asked about the work we did, and they asked whether we felt we could do something to help that school get through this difficult phase of its initial life. And our people went in there, they did a conflict audit, they tailored a programme that was suitable to the conflict circumstances, and through a series of programmes which cascaded messages and advice through core groups of influential youngsters, it was cascaded to the whole school. And over the process of, I think, about 2 years, the school went from being very seriously riven by conflict to one which got good Ofsted reports. And that really was a very, very major feather in the foundation's cap. I mean, the head teacher, the governors and Leeds City Council credited our foundation with all the good news that came from that.
There are some justice groups, not just here in the UK, but across Europe and across the world, actually, who actually find it anathema that you work with perpetrators. You have said, I know previously, that if Osama bin Laden had come knocking on your door, you would have welcomed him in.
I've said that many times. Again, I don't think we can be an authentic and credible and believable peace organisation if we cherry-pick who we speak to. It's not a question of whether you like people or dislike people. It's a question of having an open approach and saying, if there is a conflict, how on earth do we make a difference? And the only way you make a difference is through dialogue. And that's whether it's government to government, nation to nation, community to community, or individual to individual. There has to be discussion at some point. That's how you lower the temperature. That's how you begin to tackle the core issues that make people hate each other or fear each other. It's not rocket science. It has to be done. And that's why I've been able to spend time with significant leaders from the Republican community in Northern Ireland very often, whose politics would be anathema to me. I mean, I'm very patriotic and very British. I want to see, given the choice, Northern Ireland remain in the UK, but I accept people have different views. And if you can't sit down and talk to them, then you're really not involved in the peace business at all.
But how incredible that you sat down in a room, shook the hands of, had discussions with people who were instrumental in the organisation which took your son's life.
Well, I go back to what I said a moment ago. If I didn't speak to or take the chance to speak to the likes of Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, who were certainly the figureheads of Sinn Féin and for many people the IRA, then what kind of leadership would Wendy and I give to the foundation that we've created? It would be a sham. It would not be a meaningful, serious player in peace building, which is why we set it up in the first place, so Tim would be remembered for something good.
That's a spectacular attitude to have, but it must have been incredibly tough to sit down and talk to these people.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it has been occasionally. I remember talking to a former hunger striker who would have been the last guy to die as part of what was called the Dirty Protest back in the, when was it, the late 80s, early 90s, when the IRA was trying to get Margaret Thatcher to grant prisoners political status. She wouldn't bow to this demand, and in the end, I think 8 or 9 Republican prisoners took their own lives. This chap I was with would have been another one, until the point where the IRA Sinn Féin withdrew the campaign, and his mother had the authorities feed him and take him off his own kind of deathbed. And I spent some time with him, and he was a very, in many ways, a very ordinary man who, there was nothing special about him, except his conviction was so strong he'd have given his life for this cause. And of course, it's times like that you realise, no matter what your views are, your politics are, your attitude to life, there are people out there who care so deeply about what they believe in, they're prepared to take their own lives, either passively, as he was prepared to, or aggressively through using violence. And you've somehow got to meet and try and understand why they do what they do in order to formulate programs which may make a difference in these standoffs.
When in 2002 the IRA offered, quote, sincere apologies and condolences to families like yours, to the families also of Jonathan Ball, non-combatants, as they called it, who'd lost their lives at the hands of the IRA, did that mean anything to you?
Straight answer, no. No. They may have intended it to have some weight, but it had no weight at all. It's a bit like Tony Blair some years ago apologising to Ireland for past British imperial actions on the island of Ireland. I think such apologies are just hot air and mean nothing. Even if the intent was honourable, the person listening to it, I'm sure, can't really treat them seriously.
Is forgiveness a word you've ever even considered?
Considered it, yes, because it's often been put to us as something that we should do. Many times I've had conversations with people of faith who said it would be good for my soul, and I've said it's of no interest to me whatsoever. The whole issue of forgiveness never enters my mind, or indeed Wendy's. We don't forgive the IRA for killing Tim. We never will. But that doesn't stop us from being productive and positive in our behaviour through our foundation.
Many people I know have questioned as well the fact that you've said you have no interest in finding the individual or individuals who planted that bomb.
Well, what would it gain me to know? I'd then have a face and a name that I could perhaps focus on to the point where I start to lose the focus I've developed over the years, which is on bigger issues. I can't bring Tim back. I want Tim to stand for something honourable, something good. But if somebody came and said, like, I did it, I don't know how I'd react to that. I honestly don't, because I'm a human being, I'm a dad. So it's better I don't know.
Justice is what people always cry, don't they? You need justice. And for a lot of people, justice is punishing a specific individual.
Yes, we've never sought justice. We don't think we'd ever get it. I don't think it would make any material difference to the life we have. We're not even our charitable foundation is nothing to do with justice. We don't campaign for justice. There are many groups that do. So be it. We campaign for peace. We want to build peace. We want to resolve conflict. Justice for us personally as a family isn't an aspect of that.
Colin, I know your wife Wendy wrote a children's book in direct response actually to a question from your small granddaughter. She was just 5 years old at the time, asking what had happened to her uncle Tim on that day in Warrington in 1993. And the book is called Good Can Come From Evil. You've talked about before about the good that came out of that day. Can you explain what good do you see?
Well, the first tangible evidence of good coming from it was when there was a huge protest in Dublin city centre, organised by a housewife in Dublin who was horrified, as many good Irish people were, what happened in Warrington. And there was an outpouring of grief. I'm not sure what the numbers were that went into Dublin that day, whether it was 20,000 or 200,000, I don't know, but it's a very large number. And although there were people protesting on behalf of the IRA, they were vastly outnumbered by these ordinary, decent Irish people who said, not in our name. You did not do this in the name of United Ireland. And I think that was the first time we realised that there was a huge amount of goodwill in Ireland towards us as a family, and a huge amount of outpouring saying, enough is enough. And I don't doubt for one minute that was a major catalyst encouraging the British and Irish governments, and in turn the Northern Ireland political parties, of which, of course, there were many, to get around the table and do some serious negotiations. Yes, it took time, but it wasn't long after the Warrington bombing there was an IRA ceasefire, and not long after that, a loyalist ceasefire. And yes, they broke down, I grant you that, but again, it wasn't very long after that there was another one. And bit by bit, the seeds were laid whereby the Good Friday Agreement was created through consistent and coherent efforts by all parties to finally lay down a peace settlement that all could buy into.
So the death of your son, by a fashion, prevented probably the death of many, many, many more people.
Well, I believe that. You know, other historians might say I'm being fanciful and I'm crediting Warrington with more than it was rightly given, but I genuinely believe that to be the case. I don't say it happened, clearly it didn't happen instantly. Good Friday Agreement was 5 years later. But it's a process, and like any peace settlement, it is a long process. Look at the Middle East. I mean, it seems like we're never, ever going to find a settlement there. One will come one day, and bit by bit, you inch towards it. And that's what happened, I think, after Warrington in Ireland.
What does the Peace Centre that bears your son's name mean to you and your family today?
Well, as Wendy once called it, it's a living memorial to Tim and to Jonathan, but it's a huge, big, beautiful building. I mean, outside, it's impressive, its scale. The building materials are appropriate to the age we live in. But inside, it's multi-purpose. There are bedrooms, there are dining rooms, there are offices, there are spaces for workshops, spaces for concerts, spaces for parties. We use it for business hires now, so the building isn't empty. It's a multi-purpose building, but it is Tim's and Jonathan's Peace Centre. And it will always be called the Peace Centre. It will never be renamed, for as long as I'm drawing breath anyway. We are increasingly being commissioned to do groundbreaking work by Home Office, by the Ministry of Justice, occasionally by the Irish government. And that support from our own homeland government is very gratifying, to think that we've built from nothing a substantial charity, which, to the best of my knowledge, is uniquely providing the work we provide. I don't think anybody else is out there doing it. Now, that might sound like arrogance, and I could be proved wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, we are the only people doing what we do. And we're doing it well enough to attract considerable support and interest from many quarters that we have to influence.
In those terrible, unimaginable, dark hours and days and weeks after Tim had died, could you have ever imagined a time where you would feel proud of work done in your son's name?
No, not in those early days. No, I used to sometimes wonder whether I'd live another 5 years, 10 years, 1 year, with the kind of grief that was just ripped you in half. And it was hard to explain to people just how grief can disable you. And I never, ever imagined we would do anything other than perhaps fall apart after losing Tim. I think it was only because we had other children and that great opportunity from the BBC, which was a fabulous opportunity to go and see and hear and witness things for ourselves, that led to this kernel of an idea emerging. But in those early days, there was absolutely nothing. It was just hopeless and terrifying to think a handsome young lad who'd been there one day was ripped apart the next, and we're putting him in a box and burying him, and he's gone in the blink of an eye. You know, it's just incomprehensible. And the pain was just so terrible. I could never have imagined we'd be here now, what, 23 years on, talking about a brilliant charity that carries his name.
What do you think Tim would have make of the work you're doing today?
I think he'd be absolutely chuffed. I think he'd be very impressed. And he'd be, under different circumstances, for something like that to carry his name would make him chuckle no end, I'm sure. But, you know, we'd trade it all to have him back. That's a simple truth. We'd go back to how we were and where we were in the blink of an eye. Important though the work we've done is, we'd want him back if we could.
Colin Parry was talking to me, Sam Walker. Colin and Wendy's book about their son and his legacy, Tim, an Ordinary Boy, is still available, and it's really worth reading. You've been listening to What Goes On Here. Coming up next on Season 2, Episode 6, Danelle.
At times I felt like a poser because I felt I was inhabiting this fabricated identity. At other times, though, it felt, and it came to feel, very authentic that I would have this split life. It just seemed to be the life that I would have to lead.